The only authority left to us today, the only platform upon which we can build influence on our kids, is the platform of relationships. And our first principle is that rules without relationships lead to rebellion. Without doubt, the better relationship you develop between yourself and your child, the greater the likelihood there is of you having a significant influence on the life of that child. This is not to say that families don't need rules. All families need rules. Kids need to have rules in their lives, even if it's only so they know which ones they're breaking. But it is relationships that are the glue that hold the family together. And the key to good relationships, it's not solving kids' problems, it's not giving them money, it's not being the coolest parent on the block. But the key to good relationships is dialogue. And this is good news and bad news. It's good news because dialogue is cheap and easy. It's bad news because dialogue is the one thing that has suffered most in our homes and families. Stephen Glenn wrote, Stephen Glenn is an American social commentator. He wrote, "We have moved from living rooms filled with dialogue to family rooms filled with television sets. Interaction within families has been reduced to only a few minutes a day, and of these few minutes, over half are issued in one way, negatively toned communication, parents issuing warnings or reproaching children for things done wrong. Our lives have become so busy and so insular that there's no time left to have dialogue anymore. We parents are doing our parenty things, our kids are doing their kiddie things, and the computer or the TV is in the corner doing its thing. Some Australian families, in fact I would say many Australian families, are so busy the only time people get to spend with each other is outside a microwave. One waiting for dinner to come out, the other putting dinner back in." Now at this point I want to share with you a little bit out of my life, not because I believe I'm a good or noble parent. As we go through tonight you'll see that I know that's definitely not the case. But there's some things that I've learned by the nature of my work that you might find useful. My work requires that I travel a great deal. For the whole of my children's lives I have travelled. In fact, my daughter's 27, I've known her for 13 and a half years. Because every 6 months of every year I'm away. What that has meant, which by the way I accept is probably not as much as some of you or more than others. What I've found from that, though, is that if my wife and I and my kids didn't choose to spend time with each other, we wouldn't spend time with each other. What it has also meant is that I've been able to do what I like to do. And what I like to do when I'm on the road is watch television. Hello, my name is Graham, and I'm a television addict. And I'm the kind of man who especially likes to watch news and current affairs. When I'm on the road, I'll bury myself in the motel room, watch Channel 10 News from 5 to 6, and 7s and 9 together from 6 to 6.30, flipping between the ads. At 7 o'clock, I watch the real news in the ABC, and at 10.30 it starts all over again. When I'm home, I watch hardly any news. Not because I'm a good parent. Not because I'm wise. It's just that my wife simply suggested to me one day, as only wives can simply suggest, that it was inappropriate for me to be sitting watching the news at the only time of the day the whole family was sane at the same time. From that conversation, I learned it was far more wonderful to discover what happened in my daughter's day than it was to learn what happened in John Howard's or George Bush's day. It was much more fun to go down the nets while it was still light and have a bowl at my son, well, towards my son, around my son, than it was to find out how the Australian team was doing. The other thing I found with my travels with regard to sports and exercise. When I'm on the road, it's just too inconvenient. At least that is my excuse. When I'm home, if I was to go and watch 2 hours squash, 4 hours golf, that would be time I wouldn't be spending with my wife and my kids. So for the whole of my children's high school careers, my sport consisted almost solely of going to my children's sports events. And I'd be the parent who'd be there for the entire thing, and I'd run the boundary and take out notes and cut up the things and score at the table, and I'd get there for the juniors and watch the intermediates and stay for the seniors. I'd be there at 12, not leaving till 5. And I'd see the parents who'd come to pick their kids up, and they'd look at me as if to say, "He's here again. Doesn't he have a job? Doesn't he have anything better to do?" Well, no, back then I had nothing better to do. Because back then I'd go to watch my son play sport, go and drop him off, and he'd say, "Dad, aren't you going to stay?" Now if I tried that, he'd say, "Dad, you have to stay?" So I had to find other things to do. But back then that time belonged to him. Now I make a speech like this around the place, and I'll always have someone come up to me afterwards and say, "Listen, that's okay for you, Graham. You can go and watch your son play sport at 1 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, but I work for a living. What am I supposed to do?" Well, after I get the insult of that, I ask, "What happens in your life?" And the person says, "Look, I work really, really hard. I battle the traffic all the way home. When I get home, all I want to do is sit down, watch a bit of TV. It helps me unwind and become a real person." I ask, "What are your children doing when you do this?" And the person will say, "They're watching television." I ask, "What kind of television are they watching?" The person will say, "Some kind of mindless dribble." Well, I'm sympathetic to your needs. I did work for a living once. I know what it's like to fight the traffic, to get home, to be uptight. So because I'm sympathetic to your needs, if that be your problem or your habit, I'm going to ask that you make one small change. Come home, greet your spouse, that'd be nice. Grab a drink. Go to where the children are watching television, and here's where you make the change. Just don't change the channel. Sit down and watch the mindless dribble with them. I guarantee you two things. Do this for 3 days and they will notice that you're there. Do it for a week and you'll be addicted. Won't be a problem anymore. But you'll suddenly find that your children start to speak to you during the ads, but they'll start to speak to you. The other thing that I've noticed when I travel is that I sometimes stay with people. And regardless of the style of household in which I stay, two parents, one parent, both working, one working, there is still ever only one person working between 6 and 8 at night. And it's the mother. And you ladies, I can see lots of nodding heads now, you ladies get really sick of this sometimes. You're stuck there in the kitchen saying to yourself, how come I'm here backing lunches? How come I'm doing dishes? I'm a person too. I've got a life too. When you feel like that, just put down everything. Take up your cup of tea, your cup of coffee, your glass of orange juice, your glass of wine. Your sensitive new age mug of healing hot water. Whatever it is that you take at night. And go to your daughter's bedroom where she's pretending to study and just lie down in her bed. And when she looks over at you as if to say, Mum, what are you doing here? You say, nothing, sweetheart. I just want to be close to you. The first time you do this, it will be like Antarctica has moved into your house. The second time you do it, the thaw will have begun. And by the third time you actually get the hang of this thing, you'll start to relax so much so you'll start to fall off to sleep. And the moment that you get that relaxed, your daughter's going to turn to you and say, Mum, what do you think about? Or Mum, did you think about? Or Mum, did you know? And suddenly out of this kid from whom recently you only had a few words, you now get a few sentences. All I'm simply saying by these very trite illustrations, and I know they are trite, is that dialogue is something that only ever happens by accident when people are comfortable with each other. You cannot program dialogue, especially not with a teenager. You can't sit down with your kid and say, oh look, I've got 20 minutes, let's talk. Because it won't happen. We need to come to grips with the fact that most of the meaningful conversations we ever have with our children will arise in the context of the incidental. If we're too busy to talk about ordinary things, we'll never hear the extraordinary things. If we don't take time to deal with the trivial, we'll never hear about the important. But our problem is that our lives become so busy. We become too busy for the trivial. And there's a thing we miss here, and that is that for most teenagers, they're so reticent to speak anyway. They'll test us. Kids test their parents to see if parents will listen. And the way kids test their parents' listening skills is to try us out on the trivial. And if we're too busy for the trivial, they won't bother with the important. So we need to be prepared to spend these ordinary type time things with our kids, put ourselves in a position where basically dialogue and conversation is easy for them, not for us. And if we try that process, we'll find that dialogue does happen. It means making sacrifices. And quite seriously, if what I'm about to say sounds to you like I'm suggesting parents are going to forego rights, parents are going to make sacrifices, you hear me properly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Your kids are more important than Rotary. They're more important than that course you're doing by correspondence for the university. They're more important than the extra drink with the boys and girls after work, than your little place on the yacht club or the cricket club or whatever it might be. They're more important than the school PNF, which is not to say the PNF's not important, it is incredibly important. But kids are more important. Why should we make these sacrifices? For two reasons. Firstly, because if you've already got teenage children, you've got them for this much longer. This is it, folks. This is the last hurrah. And secondly, in this story, let us never forget, we are the big people, we are the grown-ups. If we don't make the sacrifices, nobody will. By the way, this is one of the reasons that mothers are most commonly approached by their children to discuss important and serious issues over fathers. It's not that mothers are wiser than fathers, that might be true, but that's not the reason they approach their mums. The reason that kids approach their mums more quickly than their dads is that mums are usually so much better at nonsense. You ladies are experts at nonsense. And I don't mean to be insulting in that. See, there's hardly a mum here and a couple of dads here, I'd say, who have spent the whole of your child's life listening to endless he saids, she saids. You can assemble and disassemble and reassemble a transformer in the dark under a blanket. You know the names of the Littlest Mermaids and all of her friends and every episode she was in. All that stuff you've listened to. You know all the play school songs. All the nonsense stuff. And in the nonsense, you've done something wonderful. What nonsense does is it lays down what I call conduits of communication, the pathways through which communication can then happen later on. And there are three things that talking about nonsense does between people to create dialogue. One is that when you talk a lot about ordinary things, and that's what I mean by nonsense, you establish a common vocabulary, a set of, I've not counted them, but let's say 150, 200 words. Important words, but you each now instantly understand the meaning. So when you're having a serious conversation with your child doesn't have to hunt around for a word it knows, and it knows that you understand the words are there. Similarly, you don't have to hunt around for words. You know that these words are common to your child, and your child will know exactly what you mean when you use them. It's amazing how different the vocabulary of parents and children in normal conversation is. Nonsense gives you a common vocabulary. Secondly, nonsense gives you an understanding of intonation and body language. I think sometimes we overrate the impact of body language, but certainly when you're working with a kid, there is about 50% of the communication is nonverbal. You learn to understand what your child means when its head goes that way. There are people, parents in this room right now, who can watch a child get off the bus at the end of the day from school and know before that child's foot has left the last step what kind of child that child had. There are others in this room here who know that when your daughter's, when she lifts her eyebrow just that way, she's about to get really upset. And when your son takes those two quick breaths, he's about to get really angry. And when he hangs his head like that way, he's really sad but doesn't know how to say it. You learn all that stuff. That comes through playing with the Transformers. It comes through hearing about the latest ridiculous rock group and what, how many different functions that new iPod's got and what this phone can now do. That's where you learn all those kinds of things. And thirdly, the third really important thing in nonsense that every parent has to learn is you learn in nonsense to get comfortable with silence. If you're not used to silence, then silence in a conversation is a very, very threatening thing. And what parents who are not used to conversation their kids will do, we have a serious conversation with a child, either something in anger or something in concern, and all of a sudden the conversation will go dead. The child will stop. A parent's natural tendency is to fill the gap, to suddenly fill the gap with words. And sometimes the words are advice the kid wasn't expecting and didn't want, and other times, because of the kid's attitude, the words are corrective words to the child. We need to understand that teenagers are stupid. Okay? They say that their brains aren't very well formed. They will say the dumbest things. So your son gets involved in this big heated argument with his dad. It's about something really minor, but the boy is not about the thing now, it's about the argument with dad. And so he just raises his voice and he gets louder and he says more things and he gets more adamant. He starts to throw his arms around more because now he's being really, really serious. And then he'll just go too far and he'll say something really bad. You think, oh, what have I said? And what does dad do? While the boy's struggling around to find a way to extricate himself from this awful situation, dad then reacts and off go the words. Or the boy might say something he didn't really mean and want to turn it around. Silence in a conversation allows you to reprocess the information. It allows both to come from a slightly different direction. You learn those things when you're having normal, ordinary conversation.